Sirs, start your engines!
Hit the pace car! What for? Because you hit every other damn thing out there, I want you to be perfect!
When I'm driving, I got a guy on the radio who talks to me. You can see him. He talks to me.
He didn't slam you, he didn't bump you, he didn't nudge you, he rubbed you. And rubbin' son is racing.
Hey, race fans, welcome to the Hoobazoo Radio Network. Welcome to Drafting the Circuits. My name is Frank Santoroski. I'll be your host for the next hour as we break down this past weekend in racing. Before we get started, let me introduce you to the panel tonight. With me is Mr. Gray Warren from Richard Childress Racing, Mr. Seth Eggert from Motorsports Tribune, Richard Uden, race engineer, and Joey Barnes from IndyCar.com. How is everybody tonight?
Very good, thank you.
I'm good.
Doing great, man.
All right. You guys sound like you had to think about it for a second. So now, Gray, for you, I know it's not the first time in your career that you're part of a Daytona 500 winning effort, but certainly you were part of that this weekend. I'm sure it feels just as good, and it feels good every time. So what's the mood at the shop? What's the feeling coming out after you guys have kind of pulled off this Daytona 500 when you weren't expected to or whatnot? What's the feeling with everybody in the shop?
Well, it's always good when you win. That's no doubt. Winning fixes a lot of things, but in a lot of areas. But yeah, the mood at the shop is great. It was a good win for our organization. It's been well talked about over the winter, the downsizing that RCR went through with the loss of the Menard sponsorship and Paul Menard moving on and downsizing to two teams, and a number of people were cut from the roster, and it made for a difficult winter. The guys pulled together, the boys in the fab shops worked some 6 and 7 days a week, 10, 12 hours a day, getting cars ready for not only the RCR teams, but the Alliance teams as well. And you got to remember, too, they had to do a model change over the winter as well, changing from the Chevy SS to the Camaro. But the guys pulled together in it. And the good thing about it, and I'm so happy for those guys that put in all that time during the course of the winter to see them rewarded for their time and effort. So that to me was really good. And anytime you win, a race, it really does a lot for the morale in the shop. But to win the Daytona 500 is a big deal for everybody. It sets the tone for the rest of the year. The team will go for the next few races riding a wave of momentum. For me personally, it's the second time, like you said, that I've been involved in a Daytona 500. It's a Super Bowl. It's our Super Bowl, and it is a big race, and it's something that you can say you were part of, and which is really cool. And like I said, I'm proud of the guys in the shop that really put forth the effort and made it happen. Now the race, on the other hand. Austin, I talked to Richard today, talked to him this afternoon about 3:00, had a chance to speak with him. And like Richard said, he said their plan was to just survive, stay out of the fray. And when it got really wild and crazy, and it was a crazy race. I think we had 18 cars knocked out in crashes through it. And part of their plan was to be careful and be patient and hopefully they would get a chance to race at the end of the race. And so after the herd thinned a little bit, obviously, you know, with the caution there, with four laps to go, when William Byron spun, it kind of re-racked the field, and Austin finds himself starting in the second row. And of course, we watched the rest is history, and he was able to come out with a win. And that's the nature of the beast. That's the nature of restrictor plate racing. You're going to have these wild finishes, and you're going to have unpredictable winners. We've seen that many, many times in the past. So, you know, hats off to those guys. They worked hard. I'm proud of them. You know, it's a good feeling at the shop right now.
Absolutely, yeah. So that was a little bit of an aggressive move right there at the end to get around the 10 car Amarola there. So a good effort from Amarola too. That 10 car hasn't seen the front like that at the end of a race in a while. Well, and also some of the other cars at the top of the order. Bubba Wallace finishing second in his first start as a full time driver for Richard Petty, and he was kind of in the mix all day as well. So, Now, Seth, you've got some stats on the crashes that you'd like to share.
Yes, out of 169 cars that participated in NASCAR events, including the Clash and the Duels, 99 were involved in accidents. 59% of the cars and trucks brought to Daytona were involved in accidents.
Yep. Go ahead.
And one other thing, the last time the number 3 and the number 43 finished 1-2, Bristol 1987, Dale Earnhardt won, Richard Petty finished second.
That's a neat tidbit there.
Yeah, that's a while back. Yeah, yeah. So, So let's talk a little bit about some of the favorites that didn't finish. You know, let's just run down some of the names here. Jimmy Johnson in the wall early. Keselowski was taken out in a crash. I don't think Logano made it to the end.
Logano did.
He did? Okay. McMurray had troubles.
Chase Elliott had troubles.
Chase Elliott looked good, and he had troubles, yeah. So a lot of really good cars out of there. But, to Gray's point, yeah, to win, you got to be there at the end. You know, to be there at the end, you've got to just try to – and sometimes there's no way out of trouble at a place like Daytona. But again, hats off to Austin Dillon, Gray, and everyone there at the shop, all of Richard Childress there. So, great job. Puts you in the chase. You've got that off your plate early in the season, so that's fantastic. So, go ahead, Seth.
What I was going to say is, with the aggression, there was also some incredible saves. I mean, Ricky Stenhouse Jr., which that ultimately set off the accident that took out Jimmy Johnson, Daniel Suarez, and others. But it was an incredible save on the backstretch. I thought he was going to spin into the outside wall off of Brian Blaney, and somehow he held on to it.
Yeah, Jimmy Johnson had a woeful speed weeks. He crashed in every event that he was in. And of course, his record at Daytona over the last 3 or 4 years has been pretty dismal. He hasn't had a good speed weeks in quite some time. What a run by Ryan Blaney! He ends up leading the most laps of the race, and in my opinion, had the car that was probably the class of the field. I believe had that last caution not come out, and I'm talking about the one inside five laps to go. I believe if that caution doesn't come out, Ryan holds off the field and probably gets the win. But anytime they re-rack the fields on these restarts, anything can happen and usually does. But strong run again for the Fords. Fords flexed their muscle throughout speed weeks, and it looked like right until about two turns from the end that a Ford was probably going to end up winning. But that just proves the mettle of Roush Yates engines and the Ford package on the speedways.
That sort of goes on a little bit to something I wanted to discuss tonight here. And I'm putting my sort of engineering hat on again here, so I'm sure some of you will fall asleep at this point. But you know, racing is a business at the end of the day, and we all know that. And anybody that works in racing knows it is a business, and you've got to, you know, your results are your income, like any other business. And I think what you saw this last week in Daytona is potentially, with these new regulations of the no ride height rule and some of the new aspects that have been brought in, it's potentially setting a dangerous precedent for plate racing or restricted plate racing. I think it's pretty obvious from what we saw that, you know, the Roush Yates engines and especially the Penske cars, Team Penske there, they did their homework on restricted plate racing. The whole Penske group sent out, and including the Wood brothers in this equation here, four cars that were the class of the field. When you hear midway through the 500 that Martin Truex Jr., the defending champion, doesn't have anything for Ryan Blaney and can't get past him, you know, that tells you, you know, what you need to know there. So you then have to look at it and say, well, okay, you have racing that is, I don't use the word contrived because I think that's slightly wrong, but designed to be unpredictable. And the reason that teams like Penske will spend so much money on cars for the Daytona 500, not just purely because they want to win it and it's the marquee event, but they want to get a return on their investment. Each of those cup cars costs a good end of, you know, between $500,000 and $700,000 to manufacture. So for a team like Hendrick, I think Hendrick lost four cars in the 500 and at least two or three in all the other races that weekend. You know, they're walking away from there with probably the good end of a $5 million repair bill, especially if some of those chassis have been damaged beyond repair. And you almost have to wonder, where do you draw the line? Yes, you want unpredictable races. You want surprise winners to a certain extent. But also, for teams to want to take these races seriously and participate seriously, and for this to be the marquee event, you have to have a little bit of rewarding the guys that are good at what they do. And, I mean, you know, no disrespect at all to Austin and the three team and everybody at RCR, he played the game that he played with the hand that he was dealt. You know, he went to a backup car after the dual races midweek because he didn't feel he had the pace in those cars. He went to the car that I believe he ran the clash with the week before. And, you know, they knew they were not the fastest car in the field. They couldn't, you know, move to the front. They couldn't move through the pack like Jimmy Johnson and Joey Logano did. And they just did what they did. I think they went onto a slightly different fuel strategy towards the end of the race there, potentially to get themselves out of trouble. So, and they've got to be given credit for that. But, you know, at some point, you've got to reward these guys for putting that effort in.
It is. And it's interesting you should say that about the fuel strategy that he did, because he came down pit road by himself one time and did it. And that is one of the reasons that he missed one of the big crashes, because he was some 40 seconds behind the lead pack. And I mean, but like I said, you know, that's just the luck of the draw, the cautions coming out like they needed to be. I mean, you know, you flip a coin, you know, your strategy is going to work or it's not going to work. And he happened to fall right into it and it worked well. I mean, we can go back and look at the same thing at the 600 last spring. You know, they played a strategy and just roll the dice and it happened to come up their number.
Do you not think in a way though that there's potential that, especially if you go through this season and you know the two Daytona races and the two Talladega races are similar to this, and you get, I don't want to use the word unjustified winners or surprise winners.
Surprise winner, yeah. Yeah, that's good.
Do you think it devalues the restricted plate races if this happens a lot? If you see the Jimmy Johnsons and the Brad Keselowskis and, you know, some of these guys who are top restricted plate racers, you know, being, you know, taken out of the races because of, you know, no fault of their own, because the regulations have been manipulated to enable this sort of driving. Do you think that it's going to, in the future, unless something changes, it will start to devalue races like this?
It's hard to say because you're going to have a segment of the population that likes it, that likes the underdog coming through and winning the races, and you're going to have a segment of the old guard or purist fans that won't like it, that will think it is a detriment, and when the guys that typically like Keselowski that are so good at plate racing and those guys are denied a win simply because they're caught up in a wreck not of their doing. Yeah, I think you'll see two segments of it, and it's hard to say what the fans, which ultimately or what we have to answer to. Mm-hmm. It's hard to say what they'll do. We're going to have segments that are going to go both ways.
Well, very quickly, I know Seth's got a quick point that he wants to raise here, but very quickly, then you also, I think, have to look at what the team owners, their opinion as well, because they're very heavily involved in the writing of the rule book and the like. And if they're finding that they might as well just, they're putting all this money in and not getting a return, and then there's other guys who aren't putting as much money in but get the result, they're going to be saying, well, hang on, look, we need a little bit of a, risk-reward ratio here, that you take the luck out of it. And mm-hmm. I know, I've talked about this before on the show before, racing, to be successful at racing, it's about preparation, and it's about doing your due diligence. And, when luck starts to become a major factor, that's probably more of a factor than actual engineering and speed and all these sort of things. It'll be interesting to see if the team are, because I'm sure if you go and ask Roger Penske right now, he want to go back to the old regulations, and he's going to be spitting feathers.
Well, and that's a good point too, because I think the new regulations that we ran under this year, the no ride height rule, we saw what that did. These cars were a bear to drive. And you saw what happened every time a car tried to duck beneath another car and got a little bit too close to the left rear quarter panel, it would essentially suck the other car around. And those cars became a handful. And I'm sure that same thing contributed to some of the wrecks that we saw throughout Speed Weeks. That may need to be revisited. That rule there, they may need to revisit that a little bit before we possibly go to the next restrictor plate race to do something to secure those cars. I think if you do some of that, and maybe the owners will step forward and ask for that, if they do that, then that might help the, what you're alluding to, Richard.
Yeah.
And that's where I was going to go with that a little bit. That this is the first time they're running that specific package, the no ride height rule. Maybe I'm being a little optimistic, but I think maybe as we go on in that package at restrictor plates, that the blocking will calm down to a certain degree. And the reason why I'm thinking that is because it used to be when they tried to block, they would practically spin themselves out. Now when they try to block, they're practically spinning somebody else out because they're taking the air off of the mm-hmm. driver. Yeah. So I think at some point, even the drivers will try to find a balance of their own. I remember a race back in 2009 at Talladega where NASCAR had an edict about no bump drafting. This was because of what happened to Carl Edwards earlier that year when he got sent into the fence, literally. And the drivers took it upon themselves just to freight train around the track instead of trying to pass a race because they felt like they didn't have a way of doing that.
Yeah, the biggest thing NASCAR's got to do with an eye towards competition. Don't react to something that basically you're gonna create another situation just like you alluded to, Seth, where the drivers instead they're going to take this away, so we're just going to line up nose to tail, and we're going to run a processional type race. They need to find a way to snug these cars up. And if you'll recall during qualifying, and some of the races, qualifying essentially, the engineers and the teams went back and did what basically a reverse skew on the cars. You've seen how we used to do the cars on the downforce tracks where we would skew them to the right, where you would get the spoiler when the cars would go into the corner and yaw, you would get the spoiler up in the airstream and create rear downforce to secure the car in the corner. What the guys did this time is used a reverse skew, skewed the car to the left so that when the car was going around the track, the spoiler was down out of the air. And, of course, that was also brought about by, you know, the no-ride height rule and raising the height of the spoiler a half inch. So these guys are going to, you know, the teams are going to do what they feel like they need to do. Sometimes it'll have unintended consequences, but they're trying to get speed in these cars. So I think, to me, they need to revisit that rule, the no ride height rule, and see what they can do maybe to help it. And you got to remember, too, another thing, too, guys. We used to go to Daytona to test the Speedway package in January before the Daytona 500. That we haven't done that in several years now. So when we, you know, you get to these racetracks, there are a lot of unknowns. So maybe one of the things that they need to do between now and Talladega is maybe have a test and go and play with a couple of things to see if they can help matters just a little bit. And it basically is just fine-tuning the rule.
Well, you say that, and I agree with you, but I do want to point out in the Xfinity Series race, and they didn't have a no-ride height rule in the Xfinity Series. There was a move that Ryan Truex tried to do on Ryan Reed, and he sucked Ryan Reed around ever so slightly, forcing Ryan Reed to come over and literally force Truex down below the WL line, ended up getting Reed penalized, and Truex trying to save it going into turn three. He saved it, but about five or six cars wrecked trying to avoid him.
Yeah.
And where they don't even have that rule, let alone an adjustable track bar in the car, or driver adjustable, that is, all the cars, even the truck series, they were moving around quite a bit past weekend.
You're never going to completely take that away because of just the way the nature, the physics and the phenomenon of the draft. You're not going to take that when you come up on a car. The guys driving the cars in the lead have to be a little bit prepared for it. You're never going to completely going to get rid of that. But you can do things. And I'm glad you mentioned that about the Xfinity Series. The Xfinity Series, to me, had better racing at Daytona than they've had in several years because of the new flares on the front fascia, around the front bumper area. I think that helped them to where the inside line and the outside line could race. You know, the last couple of years, it seemed like in the Xfinity Series, one line would be dominant and you couldn't get a run with the other line. I think this year in the Xfinity Series, that new little thing they put in the front bumpers, that little bubble thing, kind of helped their racing a good bit.
I think some of those guys in that Xfinity race needed to be reminded that the Daytona 24 was actually a couple of weeks earlier,
yep.
And they weren't racing it this week because they just didn't want to go home, did they?
But
you stole my joke, Richard.
Sorry.
But I will say this. It resulted in a record-making finish. It was the closest finish in NASCAR history as far as the top three series are concerned. 0.4 of a second, Tyler Reddick won over his teammate, Elliott Sadler. And going back to that front fascia, the bubbles that were intended as well to also try to prevent the tandem drafting, somehow Chase Elliott and Elliott Sadler figured out a way of doing it, and they got black flagged for it. And yet Elliott Sadler somehow made it back up there to nearly tie with his teammate.
Yep, sure did. I mean, he had a good the Junior Motorsports cars were very strong in the Xfinity race, definitely.
And the race that beats record-wise, a Truck Series race at Colorado National Speedway, back in, I want to say, 1996 or 1997, and that was 1/1000 of a second difference.
Yeah, it was quite a finish. I tell you what, it was a long overdue finish. What was it, Seth? Was it five restarts?
Five overtimes. Yes.
Wow. Yeah, it was nearly like 30 laps extra, right?
I can tell
24. Yeah, it was quite a few actual laps.
It was supposed to be a 120 lap race. It turned into a 143 lap race.
Yeah, wow. Yeah. So,
and a lot of teams were worried about fuel there at the end because of all the restarts. But you know, we talk about this after every plate race weekend. It's you know, it's the nature of the beast. You're running these cars on a 2.5 mile high bank track, and you're gonna have this kind of stuff. I don't know if there's a perfect scenario that you can do to get away. These guys are racing close quarters. They're rubbing on one another, and I don't think in a perfect world, even in a perfect world, I don't think that you'll always have this. I mean, you could. I think if you downsize the engines and did away with the plates, maybe, and where they had a little bit of throttle response, but you'd have to seriously downsize the cubic inch displacement of the engines to control it. But you know, I think as long as you've got, you know, racing at Daytona and Talladega, this is what you're gonna get from time to time.
Absolutely. Now, Joey, you've been quiet, but you've been typing quite a bit. So I just want to bring you into the conversation to just add anything you like, whether it be about the ride height rule, the Xfinity race, the garbage call on the bump drafting, or the tandem drafting rather. So what are your thoughts after this weekend of racing at Daytona, Joey? Because I always love to hear what you have to say.
Oh gosh. I enjoyed the truck race on Friday night of all three of the series. Obviously, the Xfinity show was great, but it had a poor ending. I didn't really like necessarily the full racing product that I saw on Sunday, but I really enjoyed from flag to flag what I saw out of the truck race. And ironically, that comes with their new OEM that's standard for a lot of the teams. I think 26 teams ran it. And
There were 26 teams that ran it. The Kyle Busch trucks, except for Todd Gilliland and three of the older Chevy teams.
David Gilliland.
Yeah.
Todd's not running until, like, Charlotte, I think.
He's running Martinsville and then Charlotte.
Yeah. But Johnny Sauter ended up winning his third straight, but this one was the first with the new engine. And you know, I mean, overall, I like the show that I saw from that. It didn't get excessive. The racing was good. It was side by side. There was some closeness. There were some close calls. We've got to do something to keep, like, the ARCA race went on and on and on and on a couple weeks ago. And you look at the Xfinity race, and it went on and on and on. Like, I didn't see a problem with the original, let's do three attempts and it's done. Maybe you're making an exception because it's Daytona, and if you want to do that, that's fine. But you can't continue to, if you're NASCAR, in my opinion, say that you care about the economics of these teams and the economics of the sport, and you're taking away jobs by taking away a guy over the wall and things like that. You're doing those things, but you're still, you know, leaving, as you had pointed earlier. I mean, Rick Hendrick's got the team there's got like $5 million in crash damage from speed weeks alone. So you can't continue to suffer those things and think that this series is healthy. So there's got to be some dynamic. There's got to be a happy medium. But overall, the quality of racing was good. I love the aggressiveness. I saw Chase Elliott was crazy aggressive. Ryan Blaney, crazy aggressive. And we need that just to cement who the next superstar is supposed to be. I mean, it's a little ironic that Dale Jr.'s former car's on pole and his daddy's old car number wins the race. We won't get into the numerology of things, but it's funny to me that we've got these young guys now who are hungry to try to take that spotlight, and that's exactly what we saw at Daytona. And I'm an advocate for that kind of stuff, but the real racing starts now that we head to Atlanta, because the mile and a half are the grind of the schedule. And so I think we're about to see if this Camaro is everything it's cracked up to be. We're about to see if Roger Penske's team and all the Fords are for real, and you know, what the Toyotas can actually have to try to bring to the table. So I'm excited for the season. It's more interesting to me now than it was a year ago.
Yeah, you're absolutely right, Joey. The real racing starts this Sunday, and we'll table the restrictor plate talk until late April, early May, when we revisit again at Talladega. And so we'll move on from that, and we'll probably have the same discussions the week after Talladega. But going to Atlanta, we'll see a different. We're going to see a different style of racing. The track should be a good race if you base it on what happened last year. The multiple groove racetrack, worn out pavement. Tire management is going to come into play this weekend. So I think we've got an interesting weekend coming up.
Absolutely. I think the next four or five races are really, you know, they're all the kind of bread and butter type tracks that NASCAR races on here. We're really going to get an idea of who our championship contenders and who our championship pretenders are. But before we move on away from Daytona, Seth, you do have a comment about numerology. And then I'm going to ask you about this Twitter stuff with Denny Hamlin, Albuterol, and Bubba Wallace.
Just the one comment on numerology. Three times the Daytona 500 in recent years has been on February 18th. And all three times they were won by Richard Childress Racing Car. One, Dale Earnhardt Sr. The other, Kevin Harvick. And this year, Austin Dillon.
So go to Vegas on February 18th and put your chips in on an RCR car. That's what you're telling me.
Exactly.
Sounds good. Okay, yeah. All right. And on the Denny Hamlin thing? Because they look like – I saw some video today, the service of him and young Mr. Wallace having a – looked like a pretty heated discussion right after the race.
Well, we have to start with Denny Hamlin's comments prior to the race weekend. He was on – I want to say it was Barstool Sports, and he made a joke that 70% of NASCAR drivers are on Adderall. And he eventually walked that back and apologized for it. But after the race on Sunday, him and Bubba were beating and banging coming to the line. And Denny just drove Darrell Wallace Jr. right up into the wall past the line. Bubba didn't take kindly to it. He wasn't happy about it. He made a comment saying that Denny had done that to Chase Elliott and Ryan Blaney at Martinsville last year, and then took a jab at Denny's Adderall comment, which Denny is now exploding on Twitter over. And Sunday, in between the two post-race press conferences, I don't know who in NASCAR had this idea, but they were originally going to have Denny and Bubba on stage at the same time, but they changed that. But Denny and Bubba ran into each other, and Denny decided to start a chatting match. Bubba just walked by him.
I mean, Denny, this is part of the reason that people can't take Denny seriously, though, right? Like, this is part of the reason you don't look at him as a superstar, as a serious threat to a championship, why we, in some cases, look at him as a choke artist, is you're supposed to be a seasoned veteran. You're supposed to be a guy who represents the series well, and you're not supposed to definitely, in this situation, speak on behalf of anybody, even in a joking manner. Like, those kind of comments aren't necessary, and even if you're joking about it. And so you're facing repercussions for it. You don't like it. You never should have cracked the joke to begin with. And, you know, I don't really have a problem with Bubba poking at it, because if he feels like he was done wrong on the track, I mean, it's certainly, what are you going to do? You're going to take a jab at something that the guy made a mistake over. And, you know, Denny should just be better than that, smarter than that, to refrain from those kind of comments.
And Bubba took the high road. And then in the media center, we had a nice moment with Bubba, his mom interrupting the post-race interview to congratulate him and his sister as well. And it was nice to see the emotion in the family with him.
Yeah, that was really neat. Yeah. So, but yeah, back to Denny, man. I don't know what has gotten into him lately, because you're talking about Denny Hamlin has got his name in the news for not the right reasons, going all the way back to last year during the chase. You know what I mean? So, I don't know if it's he's intentionally trying to do things to put the spotlight on himself. He's, you know, he's taking a page out of the Kyle Busch playbook, or if he's just that stupid sometimes. I honestly don't know.
Well, but it comes down, here's my thought on it, though, is like, we're running into a situation where NASCAR, the ratings are down. There's not a lot of fans in the attendance as much as there used to be. And Dale Jr. just left the sport for the most part, as far as the driving role goes. So there's not as much of a draw now. And you just did something that shines a huge negative spotlight on the sport, potentially. You did nothing positive in any shape or form. I don't understand where your head's at by doing that. It looked like it was a bonehead move, in my opinion.
Big time, big time. So, but before we start talking about Formula One launches and Indy 500 entries, I want to go around the table, get some picks for Atlanta, and then we'll see if anybody has any other thoughts over the speed weeks that they need to get out. But Richard, let's have you do the first pick for Atlanta.
Jimmy Johnson.
All right, good pick. Gray?
I'm going to go with the same guy that dominated the mile and a half last year. I'm going to say you defending champion is going to come to the forefront and run well there this weekend. The jury's still out on any improvements that the Ford camp and Penske has made at the thing. We'll just have to see. We could be in for a surprise, and I hope we are. I hope there's someone to challenge Toyota's dominance on the mile and a half. So, but for right now, I'm going to have to go with Truex.
That's a good, solid pick. Now, Joey, you picked Paul Menard for Daytona. He actually had a pretty good run. He actually had a great run there at Daytona. So, Joey, who do you like for Atlanta?
Honestly, I like Chase Elliott. I'm going to go with the hometown kid. And it's strictly because I think the Camaros are going to be pretty stout on the mile and a half, the side force, and things that they generated based on just the light testing that I saw at Texas. So it's one of those things with that, and as well as what I saw at Daytona. He didn't look like a guy that hoped to win anymore. He looked like a guy that's ready to win, just his driving style. So I'm going to pick Chase.
All right, good pick. Seth?
Well, since all three of my picks have already been taken, I'll go with Kyle Busch.
Kyle Busch, a good pick on any track on the schedule. I got to tell you that. But I along with you and along with Gray, I do think the Toyotas are going to perform quite well at Atlanta. So I'm going to go way out on a limb and pick Daniel Suarez, just for fun.
You're
going
to pick Denny Hamlin there for a second.
No. No, but you know what? Denny will probably go and win this one now. So, but, guys, any final NASCAR thoughts before we stop discussing Daytona and move on to some other topics?
I do want to say, at least talking about the truck series, one of the only teams that was left from the inaugural season, Jim Rosenbloom's FDNY Racing, announced that they were closing their doors after Daytona.
I read that article today, yeah.
Let's say Seth did a pretty good job on that piece, so.
Yeah, and didn't you say that was one of two remaining teams.
Yeah, the
original truck teams.
Yes. The only other one that's left is MB Motorsports, the Mittler brothers. FDNY Racing, I do want to give them at least one shout-out. In recent years, they've been donating their proceeds to the 9/11 charities.
Excellent. That's good job. Excellent. That's good stuff, yeah. So, I mean, FDNY stands for New York Fire Department, correct?
Correct.
Right. There you go. So that makes everything perfect in the world. So, all right, guys. So, Richard, Joey, you guys have been paying attention that we've seen so far 5 of the 2018 Formula One cars have been launched, revealed. However you like to say it, Renault offered you a little hologram to put on your desktop. So let's talk about the couple of new cars we saw, which were the Haas went first, and then we saw the Red Bull car, the Alfa Romeo Sauber, the Williams car, and then the Renault. If that correct?
Yep.
Okay. So what are your impressions of these cars, having seen them for the first time? And we'll see them on the track for the next time come Monday.
I mean, for me personally, out of all of them, I like the Williams the best. It has the most aggressive design. Something that we talked about before we went on air was how, you know, we're seeing a lot of the side pods get narrower. Last year it was all about the shark fins and the T-wings, and now it's more about the barge boards. And Richard can talk a little bit more about that. But I'm impressed with some of the design work that I've seen out of Williams for sure. I enjoyed Red Bull's design as well. I'm interested to see what they can really do with Renault Power, Tag Heuer, whatever you want to badge it, you know, for the immediate future, because we all know that the way that everything's funneling, it's funneling to them in an Aston Martin future. So wondering what they're going to have versus what we might see out of Renault this year, which the car was relatively unimpressive, and what we might see out of McLaren Renault. So Renault's kind of the big unknown as far as an OEM goes on what they can do to go after Mercedes and Ferrari, who have yet to launch. But out of all of them so far, super impressed by the Williams car for sure. Patty Lowe and them did a really good job with that.
Now, is this not, am I not mistaken, so that Patty Lowe actually designed this car?
I forgot the name of the guy that was with him.
Ed Wood is the chief designer at Williams, and Patty Lowe is the technical director.
Okay, I thought I had read somewhere that Patty Lowe, this is the first car he's designed or had a hand in designing.
Potentially. I mean, a technical director will normally provide the sort of philosophy for a car and the areas where, you know, you need to distribute your budget and the areas where you need to, you know, is this development a worthwhile development? Is that, you know, that sort of side of things. And then somebody like the chief designer, so an Ed Wood of the world, who's a very, very experienced designer at Williams, been chief designer there a number of years. He's the one who will actually get into the sort of nuts and bolts of the design work. And, you know, he'll work directly with the design teams to come up with the concepts that they've worked on.
Ah, excellent. So now, Richard, what are your impressions of the first five cars we've seen?
I think we've only actually physically seen two of the cars, haven't we? I think most of them have been rendering so far. Red Bull's already ran on track doing a filming day at Silverstone, and they ended up sticking it in the wall there on a wet track, which is a huge surprise for Silverstone to be wet at this time of year. But they're pretty confident that that's not going to be anything too detrimental to their pre-season testing next year. Apparently there was relatively major damage to the front of that car from what's leaked out from the people there. But I think, yeah, the Williams is an aggressive-looking car for the first time in a long time. They've sort of sat on the coattails of the Mercedes engine for a long, long time now. And I think as you're starting to see the likes of Renault come through and Ferrari, you know, improve their engine performance, and even, you know, Honda to a certain extent have done that. You know, Williams need to step up to the plate a little bit with some more of their design philosophies. Now, it is very much a what looks best off the other cars and let's stick it all together and see if it works sort of philosophy. It's a little bit more complicated than that, but, you know, it's got the high rake that Red Bulls have run in the past. It's got the sort of the side pods and barge board sort of philosophies that Ferrari have run in the past, and the front wing elements are very Mercedes-esque from last year. So there's a lot of trying to pick the best bits off from other cars, and sometimes that, you know, it may look quick, but sometimes that doesn't work as a package. Now, hopefully with, you know, somebody like Patty Lowe on board there as a pretty experienced technical director, you know, they're not going to fall into that trap. I think the Sauber looks a big improvement over what we've seen in the past. Maybe a little bit messy and a little bit clumsier again around some of the barge boards. The side pods and the actual radiator ducts look very, very small. The engine cover's slightly larger, maybe for the engine. You know, as I say, the cooling systems within that engine this year maybe slightly higher, slightly more demanding than they've run in the past. But for the first time in a long time, it looks like the guys at Sauber have actually, and this isn't being disrespectful to what them in the past, but actually thought about it and actually come up with a new package and worked over the winter rather than just get through where they've come from the previous year. So interesting. It's going to be interesting to see how the Sauber does.
I bet you some of that, though, was influenced because of who they have as one of their drivers and the fact that they now have an upgraded Ferrari engine versus the year-old power plant that they were running.
Oh, no, for sure. I'm sure that that sort of relationship between Sauber and Ferrari is always a strange one. Right? You know, Ferrari has put some input in there, and Sauber sort of, Sauber improve. And then after Sauber improved, they say, well, we don't want all this input from Ferrari. And then they slip back, and then Ferrari put more, you know, it's almost like, they keep slipping back, and then, you know, Ferrari boosts them up again. But, I think that they will probably, I mean, they're fighting against the likes of Toro Rosso and a Haas F1 in there. And the sort of big disappointment, I think, in a way, and again, this is just a launch car, and what you see now on all of these cars compared to what you'll see at Melbourne in late March or early April, isn't it? A completely different. The Renault looks very underwhelming. There's some behind-the-scene changes. I did notice in one of the comments that this is the first time they'll run a fully carbon fiber gearbox. So that, from my understanding, still leaves Williams as the only team that isn't running a carbon fiber gearbox. They've got a cast gearbox and things like that. But you just look at some of the design work. You know, this year is probably going to be, I think Paddy Lowe described it as a battle of the barge boards. And the Renault just looked very bland and very plain. It may well be that come next week when they roll out at Barcelona, they'll have a, you know, ornate, intricate barge board system, and they just didn't want to reveal it early. Possibly, you know, who knows? But it's a little bit. Oh, okay. Especially after all the noise Renault have been making, and after the huge investments that they've made over the last 18 months, 2 years since Renault came back as an owner. You know, from the staffing numbers that they've recruited massively at Enston there. So I was a little bit disappointed with that one, and with two of the best drivers that have never had an opportunity in a top car there with Hülkenberg and Carlos Sainz Jr. You know, you'd almost expect a little bit more from them, but I don't know what anybody else thinks on that car. It certainly didn't grab your attention like maybe the Sauber and the Williams did, and the Red Bull, for a matter of fact.
Well, I tell you this, is I like the fact that they have the Renault car being kind of similar to last year right now, just with a baseline, because if you think about some of the hirings they did with 6 months to go last year, I wouldn't put it past them to be more focused on the updates for the season versus, you know, trying to get everything out there for the launch. That said, you know, we know that Paddy Lowe and the car they had last year at Williams was the one that he really had a hand in touching and trying to modify. So I wouldn't be surprised if we're 6 months away from seeing the finished product that Renault presents. You know, that said, you know, we talked a little bit about, you mentioned Red Bull had kind of an episode there at Silverstone. I noticed in some of the, in the launch, that the end plates of the rear wing are actually tilted inward towards the center of the car versus other wings aren't quite like that. And I'm starting to wonder, could that affect the stability that you would get with downforce and just help stabilize straight line speed, but kind of force you to lose a little bit of the cornering ability? Because Red Bull's always been known as a dynamic chassis, but
yeah, I mean, not being an aerodynamicist by trade, but understanding the basic principles of it, the idea, and when you see a lot of these little vanes and channels in the rear wing, that has a sort of an effect coming at the rear of the car, so that reduces the what they call the that reduces a lot of the turbulence coming off the back of the car, which just makes the whole thing more efficient. So those sort of little intricacies and niceties don't really bring a huge amount of performance to the car. The comments that Ricciardo came out with, even on these filming laps that they're allowed to do, the 100 kilometers of filming, he did feel the rear end was a lot more state, or very well planted, was his words. Now, obviously, for a filming day in the wet, they'll run it at relatively high ride heights. They'll run the car, you know, a little bit soft, so they don't stick it in the wall. And yeah, that went well.
Yeah, did one job.
Exactly. But little things like that, typically with aerodynamics, there isn't one thing that you'd look at and it's a huge game changer. Very rarely do you see that. I mean, you've had things like the F-duct that was around, you know, 10 years ago. That was a huge thing. Or the blown diffuser was a huge thing. These days, when you have stable regulations, very rarely will you see a team come up with something that is like, oh my goodness me, that is the secret to what's been going on. And it'll all the little, you know, those little sort of tweaks and bits that look like they could snap off of the car if you breathed on them, they're all purely, to a great extent, cosmetic, and they're designed to tidy the air up. They're aerodynamicists work in a sort of percentage of downforce number, and they're talking like 1 and 2 points of downforce, which in measurable terms and driver feel is probably very, very minimal. Over, if you when you add all of those up over the course of a season, you would probably notice it. But you know, that little aspect of having that rear wing end plate angled, I doubt it's something the driver can feel. It's a whole package that would be a bigger impact to them.
All right, yeah. That was a rather lengthy answer to a simple question.
Sorry.
Thank you, Rich.
I tell you this, one of my final things on the F1 subject would be just, you know, we've talked about in the past, and I've talked about it among a lot of my peers, is just, you know, back in the old F1 days, reliability was a big deal, and you would suffer reliability depending on how good your development was and things like that. And I feel like last year we saw Lewis Hamilton kind of walk into the championship, and a lot of it was because he didn't have any reliability issues, where Ferrari ended up with some. And I like the fact that we're in an era again, at least even if temporarily, where we're seeing reliability become a thing and we're seeing development change. I mean, I don't know how much difference the side pods being narrower are really going to make and how much that's going to change the dynamics. I mean, that's still yet to be determined because we haven't put the cars down in Barcelona yet. But I love the fact that we're kind of back in somewhat of an old school era of development and how this car is being prepared and essentially what kind of product we're seeing out of F1.
Yeah, I mean, there's been a few sort of key tricks and key elements that the aerodynamicists have been running, you know, especially last year. You saw that T-wing, they've got rid of that. The shark fin, they've got rid of that. Another area that's been talked about a little bit is the what they call the monkey seat, which was an element that went over the exhaust outlet. And it's been around a few years in Formula One, and it sort of comes and goes, but it's been banned this year because you were starting to see last year a little bit of that sort of blown diffuser concept. And blown exhaust concept there. And those are the areas where when you see a lot of this sculpting around the side pods, especially in the barge boards, is trying to get as much air connecting to the barge boards, keeping out of the tire wake, because tire wake is massively detrimental to aerodynamic performance. And you'll often see at pre-season testing next week, you'll see lots of teams running with aero rakes in front of the rear wheels and behind the rear wheels and fully understanding what the air is doing over there, because they're such a detrimental part to aerodynamics. You want to get the air channeling around the side of the engine, around the engine cover, and, you know, through the diffuser area. So that's where a lot of that comes from.
All right, so very informative stuff. So later this week, we're looking at actually on Thursday when our show will air. Ferrari and Mercedes are going to launch on Thursday. Friday, McLaren will launch. Toro Rosso is going to launch on the 26th, which is the Monday that the test begins. And Force India doesn't have a launch date scheduled. I guess they'll just show up with a car at Barcelona. So, you know, with that being said, Joey, let's talk about the entry list for the Indy 500 now, because as we're hearing reports out of out of Mark Miles and out of Doug Bowles, that we're looking at an actual bump, or maybe two, on Indianapolis. That we've got just my unofficial count, 34 entries. That includes Buddy Lazier, who's not officially stated his intent to bring a car to Indianapolis, and that also includes the rumored cars for Oriel Servia at Rahal Letterman, and then the other one is Jay Howard is working on a deal to run that third Schmidt-Peterson car. But if it's not Jay Howard, I think Sam Schmidt's pretty intent on having somebody in that third car. So, and then, of course, Danica Patrick will finish off her farewell tour in an Ed Carpenter car, which is, honestly, for Indy, pretty darn good ride. So, Joey, what are you hearing as far as the entries into Indy, or what are your thoughts on some of these part-timers, and who should we look at?
I mean, obviously, if Danica, we haven't seen a press release yet, but she admitted to it, being in an Ed Carpenter car, and Ed's admitted to it. I think that that's a hell of a place for her. I think that she's only got one finish outside the top 10 at Indy in her entire career, and it's, I think she's got 8 starts. So, you know, phenomenal at Indy, and obviously finished third there throughout her career, and led laps, first woman to do that there. So I think that she's in a good opportunity at ECR. I've seen a lot of things about Dryan Reinbolt running two cars with potentially Jerry Hildebrand being one of those guys. You know, obviously Sage Karam's been one of their favorites for the last couple of
that's
years.
That's what I keep hearing for the other name, Hildebrand.
Overall, I talked about it before the year that I thought we'd hit 35 entries and we'd have a natural bump day, and I think it's kind of funny we run into a year where NASCAR doesn't exactly get to bump anybody, and now IndyCar gets to bump people. So the world seems to be a little bit more balanced, I guess, compared to the way it was the last few years. But I think, obviously, Buddy Lazier shows up, and I think it was last year he showed up on a Friday, the one day he absolutely had to, or maybe the day before for a couple hours, and was right up to speed, as up to speed as you would expect with the team on that kind of a budget. And I mean, it blows my mind that how many competitive rides we're going to see. I'm Dale Coyne Racing, Josh Farmer, who was with Motorsports Tribune at the Phoenix test, talked to Dale, and Dale confirmed to him that they're running four cars, with the likelihood of Pippa being one. He's admitted that he'd like to run Connor. So, you know, there's that situation. So there's some positivity going around. I'm interested to see what Connor could do, because we've seen him as a couple of oval runs now. He finished, obviously, a little different, but he finished seventh at Texas in what was a wreck fest last June, and then at Gateway, which he tested extremely well there in an A.J. Foyt car, and ended up finishing fifth, which was a career best for him on an oval. So there's some promise there, and I feel like in some ways, now that he's having to fight through the business side of racing and how difficult it is, I feel like he's somebody that can really take advantage of something like this, because he's still young enough and smart enough and talented enough to understand what's at stake. And I feel like he's going to be someone who can maybe surprise some people and make a good run. But, I mean, overall, I think 35 cars would – having a natural bump day is definitely going to happen. And of all of them, Danica and Jerry Hildebrand are probably the two I'd put a premium on to be an upset.
Oh, absolutely, yeah. So just real quick, because we've got about 4 minutes left. So, we saw last year Buddy Lazier was, pretty late to the track, but kind of knew he had a spot, But, I mean, with a bump – with a bump or maybe two, with Buddy not having any test time with the new car. I mean, Lord knows last year he didn't test. He just, showed up and got it up to fast enough for last place. You think he'll just sit this one out? Because I do know that Buddy's got some plans in the longer term to kind of focus on his son's career. And, I mean, is it necessary for him to keep showing up to fill that 33rd spot, or do you think Buddy will step away? I don't know.
I mean, I don't know. It's Indy, and it's Buddy. And if I remember right, he's close to a milestone mark for starts. Like, he might be coming up on, I think, the all-time career record for most starts in the Indy 500, potentially. Because, I mean, he's been there every year since 96, if I recall, 95. So that's a pretty long tenure, but I obviously at some point he's going to focus on Finn. I don't know how much of a check he gets, because I don't know. There's the payout for Indy is a little funky, so I don't know how much of that he gets a cut from. But at the same time, I can just tell you this, is that if you can find sponsorship that wants to slap on there, slap their name on the car. I mean, certainly the he's won it before, and he showed decent pace last year. I think the if he is going to set any of them out this year would make the most sense, because we're looking at a situation where it's a reset year for the series, right? And it's maybe it's a DW12, but you're running into a situation where, you know, we've got a different body on the car. So that's a great question. Honestly, yeah, I don't know. It's kind of a wait and see. But
yeah, it's kind of what I, just my personal thought. No disrespect to Buddy. Like I said, he's been there year in and year out. So, but we are just about out of time. So, Joey, I'll start with you. Any final thoughts on the evening before we have to get off the air?
Honestly, not too much. I'm getting primed to head out to Homestead for the Mazda Road to Indy test. There's a 4-day test out there Friday to Monday, and just excited to get that going and meet some of these youngsters that could be potentially future IndyCar champions.
All right. Well, have fun. I'm looking forward to your report back from there when you get back in town. So, Gray, what's on your mind before we split?
Well, you know, we're gonna put Daytona behind us. It was a nice win, but still got a lot of work to do, and we'll go see what Atlanta brings this weekend.
All right. We're looking forward to Atlanta. Seth, what's on your mind, sir?
I'm interested to see what news comes out. Supposedly there's going to be some news coming out about Cole Custer and a possible cup ride at Vegas.
All right. Well, good for Coleman. I hope that comes to fruition. So, and Richard, you got one more, and then Joey has one more. So, Richard,
yeah, it's going to be good to see some F1 cars back on the track for the first time since Abu Dhabi at the back end of last year. So, it'll be interesting to see what happens. See if there's any big changes in the pecking order. I think the most interesting thing, and most of the eyes will be on McLaren there, to see how they integrate the new to them Renault engine. If anybody can push Mercedes, not just purely on pace but also on reliability. Last year they already run pretty much a race distance by the end of the first day testing, so it'd be interesting to see if they can continue their dominance and how the other teams stack up against them.
Yeah, we're looking forward to Formula One getting underway again too. Now, Joey, one more final thought for you. Just your final thought, because you got negative 20 seconds to get it in.
Well, I'd be remiss, because you asked me to do this to plug.
Oh, absolutely! Yeah, go right ahead. Yeah.
Motorsports Tribune. So, at Motorsports Tribune, we have some exciting stuff that finally got confirmed last week. For the IndyCar side, we're going to have rookie Zach Veach, who's with Andretti Autosport, as our driver journalist. With the NASCAR Camping World Truck Series, we're going to have Ben Rhodes and Myatt Snyder from Thor Sport on board for our driver journalist for that series. And then in Xfinity, Richard Childress Racing driver, we got Matt Tift. So, and there's still more to be announced, but at the moment I wanted to just tell everybody that those are confirmed, and they can check out motorsportstribune.com for any of that stuff.
Absolutely. Also, you can find Motorsports Tribune on Twitter and on Facebook, as you can also find Drafting the Circuits. Find us on Facebook or find us at hubazoo.com/draftingthecircuits. And speaking of hubazoo.com, I'd like to thank Hubazoo for hosting us. I'd like to thank you, Gray, Seth, Richard, Joey. I'd like to thank iHeartRadio and Spreaker. And I want to thank all you folks that listen in every week. Have a great week. We'll talk to you next time. Thank you.
WHOOBAZOO.com. WHOOBAZOO.com.
Enter website.